Okay, we were talking about the alley problem. You were mentioning that Joe Walker started trying to...
He tried a number of different ways of making an alley and unsuccessfully. Now, there's one method in the literature by someone whose name slips me at the moment. I could give it to you if I just refer to the paper.
Yeah, it's in the paper, right?
Yeah.
I've seen that.
And this person in British, had made this alienic acid. He thought it was correct. He thought it was an alienic acid, but did nothing with it from the point of view of resolution or anything of that sort. He may have, but he didn't report it in his publication. Joe Walker tried to repeat him and couldn't get this acid to crystallize. So when the time came for him to write up his thesis, he really didn't have succeed in his object. But he did enough work, and the work was good, that Kohler felt he ought to get his PhD and allowed him to go ahead and write a thesis and got his PhD. Joe then went on to work in the state police laboratory and developed a lot of modern techniques and crime detection and so forth. One day, as Kohler's assistant, he at one time asked me would I go down to the cold room and clean out a lot of old stuff that was no longer of any use or interest. As I went down and looked at this, I discovered this vial of Metartis, Jeremiah Press, filled with crystals left by Joe Walker. And it turned out to be this alienic acid. The point was it an alienic acid or not? And I established the structure by hydrogenation, degradation, and made sure it was right. This wasn't done by the British. He just assumed it had the right structure. And then I started to try to resolve it. And at first it failed with all the alkaloids I tried. I couldn't get them to form salts. And I'm still not clear. I thought it was because the alienic acid was a very weak acid. And I still think that's right, but I'm talking to Frank Westheimer some time ago about it. He didn't think that was the answer, but he didn't have a good explanation why I couldn't form the salts. So I conceived the idea of changing that carboxyl group by reacting it with a glycolic acid and putting on an ester with a carboxyl group on it. And when I did that, as a matter of fact, the alienic acid wouldn't dissolve in bicarbonate, but would dissolve in alkali. I thought it was quite weak, yeah.
That's interesting, because I remember looking at the paper and I said, he already had an acid group there. Why did he want to extend it and make another acid out of it? Yeah.
Well, then it behaved. I could extract it out with bicarbonate solvents and so forth, and there was no question that it was a good acid, and that with brucine just fell apart very nicely on that. So that's how that happened. Actually, we should have been first to publish on an optically active alene, but Kohler was one of these people, perfectionists. When he wrote a paper, he would write a paper that take him 2 or 3 months to write a paper. He'd just go over it, rewrite it. In contrast to Conan would take a thesis and underline with a red crayon, cross out sections, add a sentence here and there, and have it all typed up and practically have it all done. Conan used to just go through these with a great rapidity. Kohler just sweated from every publication, but they're a masterpiece when he was through. Every word was weighed.
Conant had some comments about the differences between Richards, for example, and Kohler in terms of seeing the bigger picture and being a perfectionist on the how one being able to treat a problem and one being able to see and formulate a problem.
Well, he's right on that. That's correct. So this is how the amine came about.
So,
I've been lucky through my life too, you know.
I saw it was coming when you told me you went down to the cold room and there it was. It had crystallized out. Having had that happen on occasion, How did you choose Kohler over Conant at the time?
Well, I would think the reason is that Kohler, I took Chem 5, and the second semester Chem 5 was a problem. Kohler said, I'll give you a problem, and if it works out all right, maybe you can continue it, you see. Conant, when I went to see Conant about working on this, out of working with him, he didn't know me, wasn't very warm about saying, come in my group, I'd be delighted to have you. Kohler already had some idea of what I could do and how I worked and so forth in the laboratory. So this is the main reason. He was the first one. He said, fine, just continue your problem. That's how I got into it.
Was Louis Fieser already there?
No, Louis Fieser came after I started research. I was there a whole year before he came.
How did you happen to... So you got to know Conant later on, and then he asked you to help him rewrite the book.
That's correct. I took a course with him in natural product. He gave a course in natural product, which was a beautiful course. You know, we had three wonderful lecturers, Kohler, Conant, and Fieser. They were all remarkable lecturers. And I got to know him through the course, of course. But then, I guess he must have talked to Kohler about me, because I don't know why he came to me and asked if I wouldn't do this, except possibly that Kohler must have asked Kohler if he had anybody in his group that he thought could do this job. And Kohler recommended me.
Did Kohler have much to do with getting you the job at Merck, or you think it was mainly?
He did when Randolph Major came to see him.
I see, because you did say he had talked to Major.
Yeah. Okay. And he tried very hard. I know that many years later, someone sent me a letter that he had written about me to DuPont. And in this letter, he said that I was the best chemist he ever had.
DuPont was about ready to take a Jewish student.
That's right. That's correct.
Did you? I guess Wallace Crothers was long gone from.
Oh yes, that's right. He was gone.
And he left in 27, I think.
Yeah.
There was talk that he wanted to come back to Harvard when he found out that Conant had been elected to the presidency.
Well, I haven't heard that. Sorry.
Yes, yes, that, you know, that is. John Smith told me this. And apparently there was a period in which he was a bit disenchanted with what was taking place at DuPont, and he had considered it. But then after a while, he decided he would stay where he was, because his parents essentially had just moved to Wilmington. And that's why he made the decision to stay.
So he asked me about people. You mentioned Smith, Hilton Smith, taught at Vanderbilt, was one of my associates or contemporaries at Hilton.
You did have a publication with you and Frank Westheimer on it, but he told me that you sort of did the problem in two different halves too. That he had started some work. Did you know him? He finished off with Kohler, and I know he's a good friend of yours.
Yeah, very close friend. No, I knew him when I was at Harvard. We used to have lunch together. I used to bring him home. He was single then. We used to go home, and Betty would make lunch for both of us. We had a very good relationship at Harvard. Well, actually, this is work that he had done with Kohler, but it hadn't been completed.
Right.
Frank did with Kohler and Conant, and I guess he got through in pretty record time. On there, so and I'm very proud of the fact that I have a publication with them. I'm very proud. I took it over, and it turned out to be completely different than what they suspected. The structure of the compound on there is a very good problem. And as I say, I'm very proud of the fact that I have this publication with Frank. You know, I tell some of my students is, you know, I have to show them the publication just to prove it. But I did. Another person I'm very proud of, I published with, is Don Cram when he was at Merck.
Oh, right.
He and I published a paper together.
Yes. That was a byproduct of...
It was a byproduct in the penicillin production.
Right. Yes. When you rewrote the book with Conant, was most of it your writing at that time?
Yes, at that time, most of it.
I just happened to, for some reason, run across a review. It was near one of your other papers, and the review was extremely good. And,
yes, it was.
And said something about that you were very up to date, included electron theory and resonance and the importance of physical chemistry to organic chemistry.
That's right. That was kind of newish stuff in those days.
That came from what? From your undergraduate background or discussions with
Conant? No, this is with Hart.
I mean, that's what I meant, your graduate program.
Sure, my graduate program, sure. Mm-hmm. Very definitely.
Was there a fairly large change from the earlier editions at that point?
It's quite a change from the previous edition, that's right. There was a big change.
Okay, you mentioned some of the graduate students you worked with. Who else were you talking to at Harvard at that point? I mean, do you remember other?
Well, Hat Fisher.
We were talking about him this morning, too. Right.
He came to Harvard from Tucson's laboratory, and he and I roomed together for a year. Mm-hmm. And we've been friends ever since that time. And I used to talk to him a great deal, of course.
Mm-hmm. He was an instructor
at Harvard, that's right. Mm-hmm. And Chem 2, he was a physicist. Took Chem 2 course, he was in charge of the laboratory.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he worked on alpha bromo ketones too, that's why when we first met, I knew who he was and he knew who I was.
He had worked on them for Fusan?
For Fusan, that's right. But he worked on the reaction with alkali. I worked on the reaction with quinones. So we had a lot to talk about, and he followed my work very closely while I was at Harvard. There was a Jack Smith, too, that went to work for Cabot Laboratories. We used to call him, he was dark complexion. We used to call one White Smith and the other Brad Smith. Because Hilton was a blonde and very light complexion. I knew Land as a freshman.
Oh.
He took freshman chemistry.
Polaroid.
Of course, he didn't stay around, but did pretty well.
Yes. Imagine make a living anyway.
There was a person who worked with him, I can't think, it was a man student who worked with the man and helped make some of the sheets, the quinine iodine sheets that became the basis of Polaroid's business.
I guess Charlie Price was around during that.
Yeah, Charlie Price was around. I knew Charlie quite well.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's a good point. I knew Charlie quite well. He worked with Fisa and Conant, which was it now?
No. He worked with Fisa.
That's right, yeah.
He spent a lot of time talking with Bartlett because he was working on a physical organic problem
that
Fisa
right.
didn't understand, I guess. Newman was
Mel
there
Newman. Mel Newman I knew quite well. He came to work for Fisa too. I knew him quite well, very well.
Was Mary Fieser already there in the early?
Well, Mary Fieser is a fabulous person, really. When she first came there, most of us thought that she wasn't much of a chemist. But she was not a bad experimentalist. One of her, this maybe shouldn't be in the record, she had a way of getting men to do things for her. For example, we were on that second floor in that laboratory, which no longer is set up the way it was those days. It was a five-man lab, mm-hmm. and we had a sodium press there. She'd always come in to press sodium, to make sodium wire for ether. But how do you do this and how do you do that? And you finally end up by doing it, you see. But she was all right. I learned to respect her. By the time I got out of Harvard, I really thought she was quite good. And of course, she writes fabulously, she has no questions.
Any other women graduates?
Yes, Emma Dietz. Emma Dietz was...
D-I-E-T-Z?
That's right, yeah. She went on to teach in Barnard, and she's retired recently from Barnard. She married a chemist at Merck, I can't think of his name, so that it's Emma Deet something, the last name. She was a good chemist, very good. She worked with Conant.
Right.
She came to work as his private assistant, actually. I forgot where she got. I think she came from Bryn Mawr. There was a relationship with Bryn Mawr, as you know, with Harvard. Kohler went to taught at Bryn Mawr, then came to Harvard,
right.
And there was the Bryn Mawr job was sort of a Harvard type of right. post.
A lot of people had taken. Kohler was there, and
then Fieser.
And Fieser. Yeah. Cope was there.
Cope was there too, that's right. Yeah.
Somebody else I ran across recently, and I was.
Berliner is there too, or right. he's retired, I guess,
right.
now.
Right.
But,
mm-hmm.
but he was there too. So, Mary, I keep in touch with her, even to this very day. We're very good friends. And there's no question she's a fabulous person when it comes to that writing. And she understands these things. This is an amazing thing. She reads the literature and really gets the guts of the, mm-hmm. what she reads, mm-hmm. understands it and the significance of it and so forth, which amazes me. She's not been given the credit, really, she deserves.
In fact, we were recently talking about doing an Eminent Chemist tape of Mary Fieser.
Yeah, she's really a fabulous person.
She'd be willing to do that. Get the inside story of what it was all about.
And she was very good for Fieser. She really was.
Mm-hmm.
Very good for him. And
what way?
She watched over him very carefully. Really did. And she thought he was overworking. She'd put her foot down and mm-hmm. try to get him to relax and so forth. And she got him to be friendly with the students.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have picnics over their home quite a bit. And she got Fieser to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And if they weren't going to build something like a fireplace outside, she got the students to come.
We've read that often enough, too.
That hasn't changed much over the years.
did you think that any changes were taking place at Harvard? Was there a sort of a new... the Young Turks were coming in, or, Conant was leaving,
yeah.
and Bartlett, Kistikowski, and Fieser were coming in. You knew Bartlett as a graduate student.
Yes, I knew him as a graduate student.
And then
right.
he came back, and he was on the faculty by the time you left.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, then there's Woodward that came in, too. Woodward took my lab next to Kohler's when he first came. And none of us thought he was really that great when he first came over from MIT. He had such a great press.
Mm-hmm.
But of course we changed our mind pretty quickly.
He was also, nobody wanted him to be very great because he was sort of an irritating...
He was.
He was in Illinois for a year before.
Just for a summer, I
That's
think.
Right.
I couldn't take him more than a summer.
You mean at Illinois?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was...
But he was also very young. Didn't
yes.
he finish graduate school
yeah.
very early
oh,
on?
Oh, yes, at the age of, I've forgotten, I did know, 22 or 20 or something like that. But
now, had he come, or he took over your lab, so he
yeah.
didn't really come in until after you were gone.
When I left, that's
yeah,
right.
right.
Yeah.
So you didn't know him
yeah.
terribly well.
I didn't
well.
Know him, but I got to know him, of course, later
mm-hmm.
on that. But terrific person, no question.
Did he consult with Merck at any time, or...?
Yes, during the cortisone days. Not really consult, actually. We had a problem there. I would have loved to have had them, but one or two people that just wouldn't tolerate bring them in because they thought he'd take over.
I see.
Mm-hmm. On that, so we didn't take advantage of it.
So he went to one of your competitors instead.
He went to one of the competitors instead. This broke my heart because I used to go to him and have chats with him about my problems, chemical problems. He was always very free. And I think I was one of the few people that he would sit down and chat about
mm-hmm.
problems. I understood from others that he rarely would do this,
mm-hmm.
didn't like to do it, liked to talk about his problems rather than
yeah.
their problems, but he was very tolerant with me and very helpful. Terrific person. We did bring him in on the cortisone days on the total synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
It was my concept to try to get him to do the total synthesis, hoping that we might be able to use it.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out we didn't go ahead on the total synthesis. I still think that in those days, today, of course, it's a different problem making cortisone or compounds related to it. There are much better ways, but in those days, I feel pretty sure that if we had stuck to it, we could have made one of the total syntheses competitive with, starting with the steroid molecule.
Mm-hmm.
This goes back to our earlier period at Harvard from 1929 to about 1935 or so. Did the faculty there, and we've been going over their names, did they do a good bit of consulting during this earlier period? I know Louis Fieser, of course, will consult with Merck later on. But in the earlier period, with Conant...
To my knowledge, they did not. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge. Now, I may be wrong in that. Probably wouldn't have had very much opportunity to know, but from retrospective stories, I'd say the answer is they did not.
And Kohler, that you know...
Oh, Kohler never. I don't think Kohler would ever do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he does.
On the other hand, he was very free. If you go to him and ask him questions, he's very free with his time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any idea why he never go out and talk? Apparently, his classes were magnificent, and the story is that he always rewrote his lectures on a regular basis. But he wouldn't talk on the outside.
No, he never told me why. I try to get that out of him, but he wasn't the kind of person that you could talk to that way.
Mm-hmm.
The only person that really could, the story goes, that could talk to Kohler and have him pay attention was Michael.
Oh, that's right.
He used to see Arthur Michaels quite frequently.
Right.
And discuss his work. And I knew someone who was Michael's postdoctorate, a fellow named Carlson.
Mm-hmm.
Carlson told me that it was a scream to listen to Michael and Kohler talk. It was always Michael, and it was always, yes, sir.
what was Michael's role there? No, I can't figure out what Michael's role at Harvard was.
Well, he had some kind of a post, but he didn't have to do any teaching, but he had research facilities available, laboratories available to him. And he had postdoctorates working there. One of them was Carlson. The other was a fellow named John Ross, R-O-S-S. Those are two people I knew. They knew quite well. Ross was a British and English person, came to this country and went to work with Arthur Michaels. Arthur Michaels, as you know, is also a Tufts graduate.
Mm-hmm. And he had been on the faculty at Tufts until 1912 or thereabouts.
That's
about
right.
The same time Kohler came to Harvard.
But Kohler's 1-4 addition was really a takeoff from Michaels. And that's why they got pretty close to each other. And
mm-hmm.
Except he was using the Grignard reagent, alkylations, and so forth. You know, the one thing about Kohler's work is that so many of the things that go on now, these alkylations with different metals,
right,
through the enol, everybody talks about them. It's kind of old stuff,
yes,
in a sense,
really,
but different circumstances.
Right, yes.
There are two things on Kohler missed. Incidentally, one was carried out by Gilman.
Henry Gilman?
Yeah, Henry Gilman, the other by Fusan. See, Kohler was always 1-4 addition with a Grignard in so many cases. It was Gilman that came along and showed the importance of copper in the Grignard.
Mm-hmm.
And showed you can get 1-2 addition in many cases. If you put copper in it.
Okay.
And this was something that had completely escaped Kohler, but that's, at that time, everybody used to make their own magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
At least get a bar and make those ribbons out of it.
Mm-hmm. Was Kohler getting mixed products, 1-2 and 1-4, didn't realize that the copper was...
Well, it could well be.
Nobody's
really gone over the work.
Yeah, I think there's some very early work that I looked at.
Yeah, well, I think that's right.
Yeah, and there were some problems there.
Yeah. The other one that Kohler missed, but again, for the evidence at the time, the tools at the time and so forth, were such that his deductions were correct based on everything he knew at that time. But today with modern spectroscopy, it's such a different type of thing. This 1-4 edition of the Grignard go through the Eno OMGX business. Mm-hmm. And the proof of it was, one was that the intermediates, if you hydrolyze them with acids, that it absorbs oxygen and form a peroxide across the double bond of the enol.
Right, I noticed that on a number of papers, right. Mm-hmm.
Well, the only fault with that is that Poisson showed many years later, after Kohler was dead, that by NMR, that isn't the correct structure. That it's just an indole peroxide.
I see.
OOH on the carbon.
Okay. Okay.
And you can spot that pretty readily with NMR.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But those tools weren't available, and
right,
the way the peroxide degraded and everything else indicated pretty much that it had to be something like that.
Yeah.
Then the other proof was that if you had a phenyl group in the alpha position, after the 1,4 addition took place, the hydroxyl group very, very slowly came to ketonize, you see,
mm-hmm,
because of the hindrance effect. And if you benzylated that, you ended up with a no benzoate. So again, that proved to Kohler that this goes through an enol, the 1,4 addition,
mm-hmm,
you see.
Right.
Take off the magnesium and benzylate it.
Now, you did a piece of work on that. That was,
yes, I know I did.
Yeah. Okay.
It proved the 1,4 addition.
Right.
We proved the same thing happened in the, what do you call it, with the alpha bromo ketone, you get the same intermediate.
Right.
That part is correct.
Mm-hmm.
But the proof of a 1,4 addition again on the carbonyl oxygen and the beta carbon, that isn't very solid. Today, you'd say it probably just have a kind of a charge, broad charge again on the molecule, and then
mm-hmm,
depends on what you're benzylating or what you're benzylating with and so forth,
yeah,
that type of compound.
Yeah.
Like the old business of cetacetic ester getting O-methyl and C-methyl.
Mm-hmm. Word Mark. Who was your first, let me start, who was your immediate superior when you went to Merck?
There's a fellow by the name of Joe Stevens, mm-hmm, an MIT man.
Mm-hmm.
Was my first boss for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Randolph Major was in charge of all the chemistry,
mm-hmm,
when I first came to Merck, and then became charge of all the research.
Where was Randolph Major educated?
He got his doctorate degree at Chicago, no, Nebraska, I'm sorry, Nebraska. And then went to Princeton as an instructor. An interesting story about that I might mention. George Merck and his brother-in-law, George Perkins. George Perkins was the son of a famous banker by the name of Perkins. Became interested, he married into the Merck family, and he and George Merck Jr.
Right.
took over running the company. George Merck was president, he was the vice president and financial head of the company. And they decided George Merck was a very far-reaching, far-thinking person who decided that rather than to be a manufacturing chemist. In other words, in fact, you know, the first phenol process in the United States was done at Merck. You know, during World War I, phenol was cut off, and they went mm-hmm. and sulfonated and did it by the old sulfonation and caustic method.
That was Rossler, and there was a company in northern New Jersey, Rossler, and I can't remember the name of it.
Well,
it was the big phenol manufacturer.
I think Merck sold out to them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. On that, but the story I got when I was at Merck that they were the first ones to make phenol on a production scale by sulfonating benzene and then treat with caustic. And well, the point is that George Merck thought that it'd be nice to get into the pharmaceutical industry, but he wanted to set up a research laboratory which would be manned by scientists, and his hope, and in fact he expressed it in the talk he gave, saying that scientists would be on an equal footing with the best in academia. That's what his objective was. So they decided they ought to find a research director to head it up. George Perkins was a Princeton man, and George